Chapter 5. St. Agatha's Clinic for Women was in Sylmar at the north end of the San Fernando Valley. Because it was the dead of night, they were making good time on the 170 freeway up. Bosch was behind the wheel of his Mustang, one eye on the fuel needle. He knew he was going to need gas before coming back down into the city. It was he and Brenner in the car. It had been decided, by Brenner, that Walling should stay behind with Alicia Kent to continue both questioning and calming her. Walling didn't seem happy about the assignment, but Brenner, asserting his seniority in the partnership, didn't give her room to debate it. Brenner spent most of the drive taking and making a series of cell calls to and from superiors and fellow agents. It was clear to Bosch from the side of things he was able to hear that the big federal machine was gearing up for battle. A greater alarm had now been sounded. The email sent to Stanley Kent had brought things into better focus, and what was once a federal curiosity had now gone completely off the scale. When Brenner finally closed the phone and put it back in his jacket pocket, he turned slightly in his seat and looked over at Bosch. "I've got a rat team heading to St. Aggie's," he said. "They'll go into the materials safe to check it out." "A rat team?" "Radiological attack team."
"What's their ETA?"
"Didn't ask, but they might beat us. They've got a chopper."
Bosch was impressed. It meant that there had been a rapid response team on duty somewhere in the middle of the night. He thought about how he had been awake and waiting for the call-out that night. The members of the radiological attack team must wait for the call they hope never comes. He remembered what he had heard about the LAPD's own OHS unit taking training in urban assault tactics. He wondered if Captain Badley had a rat team, too.
"They're going full field on this," Brenner said. "The Department of Homeland Security is overseeing from D.C. This morning at 9 there will be meetings on both coasts to bring everybody together on it."
"Who is everybody?"
"There's a protocol. We'll bring in Homeland, the JTTF, everybody. It'll be alphabet soup. The NRC, the DOE, RAP. Who knows, before we get this contained, we might even have FEMA setting up a tent. It's going to be federal pandemonium."
Bosch didn't know what all the acronyms stood for, but didn't need to. They all spelled out feds to him.
"Who will be running the show?"
Brenner looked over at Bosch.
"Everybody and nobody. Like I said, pandemonium. If we open up that safe at St. Aggie's and the cesium is gone, then our best shot at tracking it and getting it back will be to do it before all hell breaks loose at 9 and we get micromanaged to death from Washington."
Bosch nodded. He thought maybe he had misjudged Brenner. The agents seemed to want to get things done, not wallow in the bureaucratic mire.
"And what's the LAPD status going to be in a full-field investigation?"
"I already told you, the LAPD remains in. Nothing changes on that. You remain in, Harry. My guess is that bridges are already being built between our people and your people. I know the LAPD has its own Homeland Security office. I'm sure they will be brought in. We're obviously going to need all hands on deck with this."
Bosch glanced over at him. Brenner looked serious.
"Have you worked with our OHS before?" Bosch asked.
"On occasion. We shared some intelligence on a few things."
Bosch nodded, but felt that Brenner was acting disingenuous or was completely naive about the gulf between the locals and the feds. But he noted that he had been called by his first name and wondered if that was one of the bridges being built.
"You said you'd check me out. Who did you check with?"
"Harry, we're working well here. Why stir it up? If I made a mistake, I apologize."
"Fine. Who'd you check me out with?"
"Look, all I'm going to tell you is that I asked Agent Walling who the LAPD point man was, and she gave me your name. I made a few calls while driving in. I was told you were a very capable detective, that you had more than 30 years in, that a few years back you retired, didn't like it too much, and came back to the job to work cold cases. Things went sideways in Echo Park, a little thing you dragged Agent Walling into. You were off the job a few months while that was, cleared up,
And now you're back and assigned to Homicide Special.
What else?
Harry.
What else?
Okay. The word I got is that you can be difficult to get along with, especially when it comes to working with the federal government. But I have to say, so far, I don't see any of that at all.
Bosch figured that most of this information had come from Rachel. He remembered seeing her on the phone and her saying it was her partner. He was disappointed if she had said such things about him, and he knew that Brenner was probably holding back most of it. The truth was that he'd had so many run-ins with the feds, going back well before he ever met Rachel Walling, that they probably had a file on him as thick as a murder book. After a minute or so of silence, Bosch decided to change direction and spoke again.
"Tell me about cesium," he said.
"What did Agent Walling tell you?"
"Not much."
"It's a byproduct. The fusion of uranium and plutonium creates cesium. When Chernobyl hit meltdown, cesium was the stuff that was dispersed into the air. It comes in powder or a silver-gray metal. When they conducted nuke tests in the South Pacific..."
"I don't mean the science. I don't care about the science. Tell me about what we are dealing with here."
Brenner thought for a moment.
"Okay," he said. "The stuff we're talking about comes in pieces about the size of a pencil eraser. It is then contained in a sealed stainless steel tube about the size of a .45 caliber bullet cartridge. When used in the treatment of a gynecological cancer, it is placed inside the woman's body, in the uterus, for a calculated amount of time, and it irradiates the targeted area. It is supposed to be very effective in quick doses. And it is the job of a guy like Stanley Kent to make that calculus, to run the physics down and determine how long a dose is called for. He would then go and get the cesium out of the hospital's hot safe and deliver it in person to the oncologist in the operating room. The system is set up so that the doctor administering the treatment actually handles the stuff for as little time as possible. Because the surgeon can't wear any protection while performing a procedure, he's got to limit his exposure, you know what I mean?"
Bosch nodded.
"Do these tubes protect whoever handles them?"
"No, the only thing that knocks down the gamma rays from cesium is lead. The safe they keep the tubes in is lined with lead. The device they transport them in is made of lead."
"Okay, so how bad is this stuff going to be if it gets out there in the world?"
Brenner gave it some thought before answering.
"Out there in the world, it is all about quantity, delivery, and location," he said. "Those are the variables. Cesium has a 30-year half-life. Generally, they consider 10 half-lives the safety margin."
"You're losing me. What's the bottom line?"
"The bottom line is that the radiation danger diminishes by half every 30 years. If you set off a good amount of this stuff in an enclosed environment, like maybe a subway station or an office building, then that place could be shut down for 300 years.
Bosch was stunned as he registered this.
"What about people?" he asked.
"Also depends on dispersal and containment. A high-intensity exposure could kill you within a few hours. But if it's dispersed by an IED in a subway station, then my guess is the immediate casualties would be very low. But a body count is not what this would be about. It's the fear factor that would be important to these people. You set something off like this domestically, and what's important is the wave of fear it sends through the country. A place like Los Angeles, they would never be the same again."
Bosch just nodded. There was nothing else to say.
Chapter 6. At St. Aggie's, they entered through the main lobby and asked the receptionist for the chief of security. They were told that the security chief worked days, but that she would locate the night shift security supervisor. While they waited, they heard the helicopter land on the long front lawn of the medical center, and soon the four-member radiological team came in, each man wearing a radiation suit and carrying a face guard. The leader of the group, it said Ryan on his nameplate, carried a handheld radiation monitor.
Finally, after two prompts to the woman at the front desk, a man who looked like he had been rousted from a bed in a spare patient room greeted them in the lobby. He said his name was Ed Romo, and he couldn't seem to take his eyes off the hazmat suits worn by the members of the lab team. Brenner badged Romo and took charge. Bosch didn't object. He knew that they were now on turf where the federal agent would be best suited to walk point and maintain investigative velocity.
"We need to go to the hot lab and check the materials inventory," Brenner said. "We also need to see any records or key card data that will show us who has been in and out of there in the last 24 hours.
Romo didn't move. He paused as if groping for understanding of the scene in front of him.
"What's this about?" he finally asked.
Brenner took a step closer to him and invaded his space.
"I just told you what it's about," he said. "We need to get into the hot lab in oncology. If you can't get us in there, then find somebody who can, now."
"I gotta make a call first," Romo said.
"Good. Make it. I'll give you 2 minutes, and then we're going to run you over."
The whole time he was making the threat, Brenner was smiling and nodding. Romo took out a cell phone and stepped away from the group to make the call. Brenner gave him the space. He looked at Bosch with a sardonic smile.
"Last year, I did a security survey here. They had a key lock on the lab and the safe, and that was it. They upgraded after that. But you build a better mousetrap, and the mice get smarter."
Bosch nodded. 10 minutes later, Bosch, Brenner, Romo, and the rest of the lab team all stepped out of the elevator in the medical clinic's basement. Romo's boss was on his way in, but Brenner was not waiting. Romo used a key card to gain entrance to the oncology lab. The lab was deserted. Brenner found an inventory sheet and a lab log on an entrance desk and started reading. Bosch noticed a small video monitor on the desk that showed a camera view of a safe.
"He was here," Brenner said.
"When?" Bosch asked.
7 o'clock, according to this."
Bosch pointed to the monitor.
"Does that record?" he asked Romo. "Can we see what Kent did when he was in there?"
Romo looked at the monitor as though it were the first time he'd ever seen it.
Nah, it's just a monitor," he finally said. "Whoever is on the desk is supposed to watch whatever is taken out of the safe."
Romo pointed to the far end of the lab where there was a large steel door. The trefoil warning symbol for radioactive materials was posted on it at eye level, along with a sign. "Caution. Radiation hazard. Protective equipment must be worn. Cuidado. Peligro de radiación. Equipo de protección debe ser usado." Bosch noticed that the door had a push-button combination lock as well as a magnetic key card swipe slot.
"It says here that he took one source of cesium," Brenner said as he continued to study the log. "One tube. It's a transfer case. He was taking the source over to Burbank Medical Center for a procedure there. It names the case, a patient named Hanover. It says that there were 31 pieces of cesium left in inventory."
"Is that all you need, then?" Romo asked.
"No," Brenner said.
"We have to physically inspect the inventory. We'll need to enter the safe room and then open the safe. What's the combination?"
"I don't have it," Romo said.
"Who does?"
"The physicist, the head of the lab, the chief of security."
"And where is the chief of security?"
"I told you, he's coming."
"Get him on the speaker."
Brenner pointed to the phone on the desk. Romo sat down. He put the phone on speaker and tapped in a number from memory. It was answered immediately.
"This is Richard Romo."
Ed Romo leaned forward to the phone and looked as though he was embarrassed by the revelation of the obvious nepotism at play.
Yeah, Dad, this is Ed. The man from the FBI...
"Mr. Romo," Brenner cut in. "This is Special Agent John Brenner of the FBI. I believe we met and spoke about security issues a year ago. How far away are you, sir?"
20 to 25 minutes.
"I remember."
"That's too far, sir. We need to open the hot lab safe right now to determine its contents."
"You can't open that without hospital approval. I don't care who the..."
Mr. Romo, we have reason to believe the contents of the safe were turned over to people without the interests or safety of the American people in mind. We need to open the safe so that we know exactly what is here and what is missing. And we can't wait 20 to 25 minutes to do it. Now, I have properly identified myself to your son, and I have a radiation team in the lab right now. We have to move, sir. Now, how do we open the safe?
There was a silence from the speakerphone for a few moments. Then Richard Romo relented.
Ed, I take it you're calling from the desk in the lab?
Yeah.
Okay, unlock it and open the bottom left drawer.
Ed Romo rolled his chair back and studied the desk. There was a key lock on the upper left drawer that apparently unlocked all three drawers.
Which key?
He asked.
Hold on.
Over the speakerphone, there was the sound of a key ring being jingled.
Try 1414.
Ed Romo pulled a key ring off his belt and went through the keys until he found one stamped with the number 1414. He then inserted it into the lock on the desk drawer and turned it. The bottom drawer was now unlocked, and he pulled it open.
Got it.
Okay, there's a binder in the drawer. Open it up and look for the page with the combination lists for the safe room. It's changed week to week.
Holding the binder in his hands, Romo started to open it at an angle that would only allow him to see the contents. Brenner reached across the desk and roughly took the binder from him. He opened it on the desk and started leafing through pages of safety protocols.
Where is it?
He said impatiently to the speakerphone.
It should be in the final section. It will be clearly marked as hot lab combinations. There's one catch, though. We used the previous week. The combination for the current week is wrong. Use last week's combo.
Brenner found the page and drew his finger down the listing until he found the combination for the previous week.
Okay, got it. What about the safe inside?
Richard Romo answered from his car.
You will use the key card again and another combination. That one I know. It doesn't change. It is 666.
Original.
Brenner held his hand out to Ed Romo.
Give me your key card.
Romo complied, and Brenner then handed the card to Ryan.
Okay, go, Brenner ordered.
The door combo is 56184, and you heard the rest.
Ryan turned and pointed to one of the others in hazmat suits.
It'll be tight in there. Just Miller and I go in.
The leader and his chosen second snapped on their face guards and used the key card and combination to open the safe room door. Miller carried the radiation monitor, and they entered the safe room, pulling the door closed behind them.
You know, people go in there all the time, and they don't wear space suits, Ed Romo said.
I'm happy for them, Brenner said. This situation is a little different, don't you think? We don't know what may or may not have been let loose in that environment.
I was just saying, Romo said defensively.
Then do me a favor and don't say anything, son. Let us do our job.
Bosch watched on the monitor and soon saw a glitch in the security system. The camera was mounted overhead, but as soon as the team leader bent down to type the combination into the material safe, he blocked the camera's view of what he was doing. Bosch knew that even if someone had watched Kent when he went into the safe at 7 p.m. the evening before, he could easily have hidden what he was taking. Less than a minute after going into the safe room, the two men in hazmat suits stepped out. Brenner stood up. The men unsnapped their face guards, and Ryan looked at Brenner. He shook his head. "The safe's empty," he said. Brenner pulled his phone from his pocket, but before he could punch in a number, Ryan stepped forward, holding out a piece of paper torn from a spiral notebook. "This was all that was left," he said.
Bosch looked over Brenner's shoulder at the note. It was scribbled in ink and difficult to decipher.
Brenner read it out loud.
"I am being watched. If I don't do this, they'll kill my wife. 32 sources cesium. God forgive me. No choice."
Chapter 7.
Bosch and the federal agents stood silently. There was an almost palpable sense of dread hanging in the air in the oncology lab. They had just confirmed that Stanley Kent took 32 capsules of cesium from the safe at St. Agatha's and then most likely turned them over to persons unknown. Those persons unknown had then executed him up on the Mulholland Overlook. 32 capsules of cesium, Bosch said. How much damage could that do? Brenner looked at him somberly.
We would have to ask the science people, but my guess is that it could get the job done, he said. If somebody out there wants to send a message, it would be heard loud and clear.
Bosch suddenly thought of something that didn't fit with the known set of facts. Wait a minute, he said. Stanley Kent's radiation ring showed no exposure. How could he have taken all the cesium out of here and not lit up those warning devices like a Christmas tree? Brenner shook his head dismissively.
He obviously used a pig.
A what?
The pig is what they call the transfer device. It basically looks like a lead mop bucket on wheels. With a secured top, of course. It's heavy and built low to the ground. Like a pig. So they call it a pig.
And he could just waltz right in and out of here with something like that? Brenner pointed at the clipboard on the desk. Inter-hospital transfers of radioactive sources for cancer treatment are not unusual, he said. He signed out one source but then took them all. That's what was unusual. But who was going to open up the pig and check? Bosch thought about the indentations he had seen in the floor of the Porsche's trunk. Something heavy had been carried in the car and was then removed. Now Bosch knew what it was, and it was just one more indication of the worst-case scenario. Bosch shook his head, and Brenner thought it was because he was making a judgment about security in the lab.
Let me tell you something, the agent said. Before we came in last year and revamped their security, anybody wearing a doctor's white coat could have walked right in here and gotten whatever he wanted out of the safe. Security was nothing.
I wasn't making a comment on security. I have to make a call, Brenner said.
He moved away from the others and pulled out his cell phone. Bosch decided to make his own call. He pulled out his phone, found a corner for privacy, and called his partner.
Ignacio, it's me. I'm just checking in. Call me Iggy Harry.
What's happening with you?
Nothing good. Kent emptied the safe. All the cesium is gone.
Are you kidding me? That's the stuff you said could be used to make a dirty bomb?
That's the stuff, and it looks like he turned over enough of it to do the job.
Are you still at the scene?
Yeah, and listen, I've got a kid here who might have been a witness.
What do you mean, might have been a witness? Who is it, a neighbor?
No, it's sort of a screwy story. You know that house that was supposedly Madonna's?
Yeah?
Yeah, well, she used to own it, but doesn't anymore. I go up there to knock on the door, and the guy who lives there now says he didn't see or hear anything. I'm getting the same thing at every door I knock on. So anyway, I'm leaving when I spot this guy hiding behind these big potted trees in the courtyard. I draw down on him and call back up, you know, thinking maybe he's our shooter from the Overlook. But that's not what it is. Turns out it's a kid, 20 years old, and just off the bus from Canada. And he thinks Madonna's still living in the house. He's got a star map that still lists her as living there, and he's trying to see her or something, like a stalker. He climbed over a wall to get into the courtyard.
Did he see the shooting?
He claims he didn't see or hear anything, but I don't know, Harry. I'm thinking he might have been stalking Madonna's place when the thing went down on the Overlook. He then hides and tries to wait it out, only I find him first.
Bosch was missing something in the story.
Why would he hide? Why wouldn't he just get the hell out of there? We didn't find the body till 3 hours after the shooting.
Yeah, I know, that part doesn't make sense. Maybe he was just scared or thought if he was seen in the vicinity of the body, he might get tagged as a suspect or something.
Bosch nodded. It was a possibility.
You holding him on the trespass? He asked.
Yeah, I talked to the guy who bought the place from Madonna and he'll work with us. He'll press charges if we need him to, so don't worry. We can hold him and work him with it.
Good. Take him downtown, put him in a room, and warm him up.
You got it, Harry.
And Ignacio, don't tell anybody about the cesium.
Right, I won't.
Bosch closed the phone before Ferris could tell him to call him Iggy again. He listened to the end of Brenner's conversation. It was obvious that he wasn't talking to Walling. His manner and tone of voice was deferential. He was talking to a boss.
According to the log here, 7 o'clock, he said. That puts the transfer at the Overlook at about 8, so we're talking about a 6.5-hour lead at this point.
Brenner listened some, and then started to speak several times, but was repeatedly cut off by the person on the other end of the line.
Yes, sir, he finally said. Yes, sir, we're on our way back in now.
He closed the phone and looked at Bosch.
I'm going back in on the chopper. I have to lead a teleconference debriefing with Washington. I take you with me, but I think you'd be better off on the ground chasing the case. I left my keys with Agent Walling. She'll bring my car back.
No problem.
Did your partner come up with a witness? Is that what I heard?
Bosch had to wonder how Brenner had picked that up while conducting his own phone conversation.
Maybe, but it sounds like a long shot. I'm going downtown to see about that right now.
Brenner nodded solemnly, then handed Bosch a business card.
If you get anything, give me a call. All my information is on it. Anything at all, call.
Bosch took the card and put it in his pocket. He and the agents then left the lab, and a few minutes later, he watched the federal chopper take off into the black sky. He got in his car and pulled out of the clinic's parking lot to head south. Before hitting the freeway, he gassed up at a station on San Fernando Road. Traffic coming down into the center of the city was light, and he cruised at a steady 80. He turned the stereo on and picked a CD from the center console without looking at what it was. 5 notes into the first song, he knew it was a Japanese import from bassist Ron Carter. It was good driving music, and he turned it up. The music helped Bosch smooth out his thoughts. He realized the case was shifting. The feds, at least, were chasing the missing cesium instead of the killers. There was a subtle difference there that Bosch thought was important. He knew that he needed to keep his focus on the Overlook and not lose sight at any time of the fact that this was a murder investigation.
Find the killers, you find the cesium, he said out loud.
When he got downtown, he took the Los Angeles Street exit and parked in the front lot at police headquarters. At this hour, nobody would care that he wasn't a VIP or a member of command staff. Parker Center was on its last legs. For nearly a decade, a new police headquarters had been approved for construction, but because of repeated budgetary and political delays, the project had only inched toward realization. In the meantime, little had been done to keep the current headquarters from sliding into decrepitude. Now the new building was underway, but it was an estimated 4 years from completion. Many who worked in Parker Center wondered if it could last that long. The RHD squad room on the third floor was deserted when Bosch got there. He opened his cell phone and called his partner.
Where are you?
Hey, Harry, I'm at SID. I'm getting what I can so I can start putting the murder book together.
Are you in the office?
I just got here.
Where'd you put the wit?
I've got him cooking in room 2. You want to start with him?
Might be good to hit him with somebody he hasn't seen before. Somebody older.
It was a delicate suggestion. The potential witness was Ferris's find. Bosch wouldn't move in on him without his partner's at least tacit approval. But the situation dictated that someone with Bosch's experience would be better conducting such an important interview.
Have at him, Harry. When I get back, I'll watch in the media room. If you need me to come in, just give me the signal.
Right.
I made fresh coffee in the captain's office if you want it.
Good, I need it.
But first, tell me about the witness.
His name is Jesse Mitford from Halifax. He's kind of a drifter. He told me he hitchhiked down here and has been staying in shelters and sometimes up in the hills when it's warm enough. That's about it.
It was pretty thin, but it was a start.
Maybe he was going to sleep up there in Madonna's courtyard. That's why he didn't split.
I didn't think about that, Harry. You might be right.
I'll be sure to ask him.
Bosch ended the call, got his coffee mug out of his desk drawer, and headed to the RHD captain's office. There was an anteroom where the secretary's desk was located, as well as a table with a coffee maker. The smell of fresh brewed coffee hit Bosch as he entered, and that alone almost gave him the caffeine charge he needed. He poured a cup, dropped a buck in the basket, and then headed back to his desk. The squad room was designed with long rows of facing desks, so that partners sat across from each other. The design afforded no personal or professional privacy. Most of the other detective bureaus in the city had gone to cubicles with sound and privacy walls, but at Parker Center, no money was spent on improvements because of the impending demolition. Since Bosch and Ferris were the newest additions to the squad, their desk tandem was located at the end of a line in a windowless corner where the air circulation was bad, and they would be furthest from the exit in case of an emergency, like an earthquake. Bosch's workspace was neat and clean, just as he had left it. He noticed a backpack and a plastic evidence bag on his partner's desk across from him. He reached over and grabbed the backpack first. He opened it and found it contained mostly clothing and other personal items belonging to the potential witness. There was a book called Cell by Stephen King and a bag with toothpaste and a toothbrush in it. It all amounted to the meager belongings of a meager existence. He returned the backpack and reached across for the evidence bag next. It contained a small amount of U.S. currency, a set of keys, a thin wallet, and a Canadian passport. It also contained a folded Homes of the Stars map that Bosch knew was the kind sold on street corners all around Hollywood. He unfolded it and located the overlook off Mulholland Drive above Lake Hollywood. Just to the left of the location, there was a black star with the number 23 in it. It had been circled with an ink pen. He checked the map's index, and star number 23 said, Madonna's Hollywood Home. The map had obviously not been updated with Madonna's movements, and Bosch suspected that few of the star locations and their attendant celebrity listings were accurate. This explained why Jesse Mitford had been stalking a house where Madonna no longer lived. Bosch refolded the map, put all the property back in the evidence bag, and returned it to his partner's desk. He then got a legal pad and a rights waiver out of a drawer and stood up to go to interview room 2, which was located in a hallway off the back of the squad room. Jesse Mitford looked younger than his years. He had curly dark hair and ivory white skin. He had a stubble of chin hair that looked like it might have taken him his whole life to grow. He had silver rings piercing one nostril and one eyebrow. He looked alert and scared. He was seated at a small table in the small interview room. The room smelled of body odor. Mitford was sweating, which of course was the object. Bosch had checked the thermostat in the hallway before coming in. Ferris had set the temperature in the interview room to 82.
Jesse, how you doing? Bosch asked as he took the empty seat across from him.
Not so good. It's hot in here.
Really?
Are you my lawyer?
No, Jesse, I'm your detective. My name's Harry Bosch. I'm a homicide detective, and I'm working the Overlook case.
Bosch put both his legal pad and his coffee mug down on the table. He noticed that Mitford still had handcuffs on. It was a nice touch by Ferris to keep the kid confused, scared, and worried.
I told the Mexican detective I didn't want to talk anymore. I want a lawyer.
Bosch nodded. He's Cuban-American, Jesse, he said. And you don't get a lawyer. Lawyers are for U.S. citizens only.
This was a lie, but Bosch was banking on the 20-year-old's not knowing this.
You're in trouble, kid, he continued. It's one thing to be stalking an old girlfriend or boyfriend. It's something else with a celebrity. This is a celebrity town in a celebrity country, Jesse, and we take care of our own. I don't know what you've got up there in Canada, but the penalties here for what you were doing tonight are pretty stiff.
Mitford shook his head as if he could ward off his problems that way.
But I was told that she doesn't even live there anymore. Madonna, I mean. So I wasn't really stalking her then. It would just be trespassing.
Now Bosch shook his head. It's about intent, Jesse. You thought she might be there. You had a map that said she was there. You even circled the spot. So as far as the law goes, that constitutes stalking a celebrity.
Then why do they sell maps to stars' homes?
And why do bars have parking lots when drunk driving is illegal? We're not going to play that game, Jesse. The point is there's nothing on the map that says anything about it being okay to jump over a wall and trespass. You know what I mean? Mitford dropped his eyes to his manacled wrists and sadly nodded.
Tell you what, though, Bosch said. You can cheer up because things aren't as bad as they seem. You've got stalking and trespassing charges here, but I think we can probably get this all fixed up and taken care of if you agree to cooperate with me.
Mitford leaned forward.
But like I told that Cuban detective, I didn't see anything.
Bosch waited a long moment before responding. I don't care what you told him. You're dealing with me now, son. And I think you're holding back on me.
No, I'm not, I swear to God.
He held his hands open and as wide as the cuffs allowed in a pleading gesture. But Bosch wasn't buying it. The kid was too young to be a liar capable of convincing Bosch. He decided to go right at him.
Let me tell you something, Jesse. My partner is good, and he's going places in the department. No doubt about that. But right now, he's a baby. He's been a detective for about as long as you've been growing that peach fuzz on your chin. Me, I've been around, and that means I've been around a lot of liars. Sometimes I think all I know are liars. And Jesse, I can tell. You're lying to me, and nobody lies to me.
No, I...
And so, what you've got here is about 30 seconds to start talking to me, or I'm just going to take you down and book you into county lockup. I'm sure there's going to be somebody waiting in there who will have a guy like you singing O Canada into the mic before sunup. You see, that's what I meant about there being stiff penalties for stalking.
Mitford stared down at his hands on the table. Bosch waited, and 20 seconds slowly went by. Finally, Bosch stood up.
Okay, Jesse, stand up. We're going.
Wait.
For what? I said stand up. Let's go. This is a murder investigation, and I'm not wasting time on...
All right, I'll tell you.
I saw the whole thing, okay? I saw everything.
Bosch studied him for a moment. You're talking about the Overlook, he asked. You saw the shooting on the Overlook?
I saw everything, man.
Bosch pulled his chair out and sat back down. Chapter 8. Bosch stopped Jesse Mitford from speaking until he signed a rights waiver. It didn't matter that he was now considered a witness to the murder that took place on the Mulholland Overlook. Whatever it was that he witnessed, he saw because he was in the act of committing his own crime, trespassing, and stalking. Bosch had to make sure there were no mistakes on the case. No fruit of the poison tree appeal. No blowback. The stakes were high. The feds were classic second-guessers, and he knew he had to do this right.
Okay, Jesse, he said when the waiver form was signed. You are going to tell me what you saw and heard up on the Overlook. If you are truthful and helpful, I'm going to drop all charges and let you walk out of here a free man.
Technically, Bosch was overstating his hand. He had no authority to drop charges or make deals with criminal suspects. But he didn't need it in this case because Mitford had not yet been formally charged with anything. Therein lay Bosch's leverage. It came down to semantics. What Bosch was really offering was to not proceed with charging Mitford in exchange for the young Canadian's honest cooperation.
I understand, Mitford said.
Just remember, only the truth, only what you saw and heard, nothing else.
I understand.
Hold up your hands.
Mitford raised his wrists, and Bosch used his own key to remove his partner's handcuffs. Mitford immediately began to rub them to get circulation going again. It reminded Bosch of seeing Rachel rub Alicia Kent's wrists.
Feel better? He asked.
Yeah, good,
Mitford replied. Okay, then. Let's start from the top. Tell me where you came from, where you were going, and exactly what you saw up on the Overlook.
Mitford nodded and then took Bosch through a 20-minute story that began on Hollywood Boulevard with the purchase of the star map from a curbside vendor and his long trek on foot up into the hills. His journey took nearly 3 hours and probably accounted most for the odor emanating from his body. He told Bosch that by the time he got up to Mulholland Drive, it was getting dark and he was tired. The house where the map said Madonna lived was dark inside. No one appeared to be home. Disappointed, he decided to rest from his long journey and to wait and see if the pop singer he wanted to meet would arrive home later. He found a spot behind some bushes where he could lean back against the exterior of the wall that surrounded the home of his quarry. He didn't use that word. And wait. Mitford said he fell asleep there until something woke him up.
What woke you up? Bosch asked.
Voices. I heard voices.
What was said?
I don't know. It was just what woke me up.
How far were you from the overlook?
I don't know. Like 50 meters, I think. I was pretty far away.
What was said after you were awake and you could hear?
Nothing. They stopped.
All right, then. What did you see when you woke up?
I saw three cars parked by the clearing. One was a Porsche, and the other two were bigger. I don't know the kind, but they were sort of the same.
Did you see the men on the overlook?
No, I didn't see anybody. It was too dark out there. But then I heard a voice again, and it was coming from over there. In the dark, it was like a yell. Right at the moment I looked, there were two quick flashes and shots. Like muffled shots. I could see somebody in the clearing on his knees. You know, in the flash of light. But it was so quick that was all I saw.
Bosch nodded. This is good, Jesse. You're doing good. Let's just go over this part again so we have it right. You were asleep, and then voices woke you up, and you looked out and saw the three cars. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Then you heard a voice again, and you looked toward the overlook. Just then the shots were fired. Is all of that right?
Right.
Bosch nodded, but he knew that Mitford might be simply telling Bosch what he wanted to hear. He had to test the kid to make sure that wasn't happening. Now, you said that in the flash from the gun you saw the victim drop to his knees. Is that right?
No, not exactly.
Then tell me exactly what you saw.
I think he was on his knees already. It was so fast, I wouldn't have seen him drop to his knees, like you said. I think he was already kneeling.
Bosch nodded. Mitford had passed the first test. Okay, good point. Now let's talk about what you heard. You said you heard somebody yell right before the shots, right?
Right.
Okay, what did that person yell?
The young man thought for a moment and then shook his head.
I'm not sure.
Okay, that's all right. We don't want to say anything we're not sure about. Let's try an exercise and see if that helps. Close your eyes.
What?
Just close your eyes, Bosch said. Think about what you saw. Try to bring up the visual memory and the audio will follow. You are looking at the three cars and then a voice pulls your attention toward the overlook. What did the voice say?
Bosch spoke calmly and soothingly. Mitford followed his instructions and closed his eyes. Bosch waited.
I'm not sure,
the young man finally said.
I can't get it all. I think he was saying something about Allah, and then he shot the guy.
Bosch held perfectly still for a moment before responding.
Allah? You mean the Arabic word Allah?
I'm not sure. I think so.
What else did you hear?
Nothing else. The shots cut it off, you know. He started yelling about Allah and then the shot drowned the rest out.
You mean like Allah Akbar? Is that what he yelled?
I don't know. I just heard the Allah part.
Could you tell if he had an accent?
An accent? I couldn't tell. I only heard the one thing.
British? Arabic?
I really couldn't tell. I was too far away and I only heard the one word.
Bosch thought about this for a few moments. He remembered that he had read about the cockpit recordings from the 9/11 attacks. The terrorists called out, Allah Akbar, God is greatest, at the last moment. Did one of Stanley Kent's killers do the same?
Again, he knew he had to be careful and thorough. Much of the investigation could hinge on the one word Mitford thought he had heard from the Overlook.
Jesse, what did Detective Ferris tell you about this case before he put you in this room?
The witness shrugged.
He didn't tell me anything, really.
He didn't tell you what we think we're looking at here, or what direction the case may be going?
No, none of that.
Bosch looked at him for a few moments.
Okay, Jesse, he finally said. What happened next?
After the shots, somebody ran from the clearing to the cars. There was a streetlight out there, and I saw him. He got into one of the cars, and he backed it up close to the Porsche. Then he popped the trunk and got out. The Porsche's trunk was already open.
Where was the other man while he did this?
Mitford looked confused.
I guess he was dead.
No, I mean the second bad guy. There were two bad guys and one victim, Jesse. Three cars, remember?
Bosch held up three fingers as a visual aid.
I only saw one bad guy,
Mitford said. The shooter.
Somebody else stayed in the car that was behind the Porsche, but he never got out.
He just stayed in that other car the whole time?
That's right. In fact, right after the shooting, that car made a U-turn and drove away.
And the driver never got out the whole time he was at the Overlook?
Not while I was looking.
Bosch thought about this for a moment. What Mitford had described indicated a real division of labor between the two suspects. This mirrored the description of events that Alicia Kent had given earlier. One man questioning her and then translating and giving orders to the second.
Bosch assumed it was the English speaker who had remained in the car at the Overlook.
Okay, he finally said. Go back to the story, Jesse. You said that right after the shooting, one guy drives away, while the other backs up closer to the Porsche and pops the trunk. Then what happened?
He got out and took something from the Porsche and put it in the other car's trunk. It was really heavy, and he had a hard time with it. It looked like it had handles on the sides because of the way he was holding it.
Bosch knew that he was describing the pig used to transport radioactive materials. Then what?
He just got back in the car and drove off. He left the trunk open on the Porsche.
And you saw nobody else?
Nobody else, I swear.
Describe the man you did see.
I can't really describe him. He was wearing a sweatshirt with the hood up. I never really saw his face or anything. I think that under the hood he was wearing a ski mask, too.
Why do you think that? Mitford shrugged again.
I don't know. It just seemed that way to me. I might be wrong.
Was he big? Was he small?
I think he was average, maybe a little short.
What did he look like?
Bosch had to try again. It was important. But Mitford shook his head.
I couldn't see him, he insisted. I'm pretty sure he had a mask.
Bosch didn't give up. White, black, Middle Eastern?
I couldn't tell. He had the hood and the mask, and I was so far away.
Think about the hands, Jesse. You said there were handles on the thing he transferred from one car to the other. Could you see his hands? What color were his hands?
Mitford thought for a moment, and his eyes brightened.
No, he wore gloves. I remember the gloves because they were those real big kind, like the guys wear who work on the trains back in Halifax. Heavy duty with the big cuffs, so they don't get burned.
Bosch nodded. He had been fishing for one thing, but got something else, protective gloves. He wondered if they were gloves specifically designed for handling radioactive material. He realized that he had forgotten to ask Alicia Kent if the men who entered her house had worn gloves. He hoped that Rachel Walling had covered all the details again when she was left with her. Bosch paused there. Sometimes the silences are the most uneasy moments for a witness. They start to fill in the blanks. But Mitford said nothing. After a long moment, Bosch continued.
Okay, we had two cars up there besides the Porsche. Describe the car that backed up to the Porsche.
I can't, really. I know what Porsches look like, but I couldn't tell about the other cars. Both were a lot bigger, like with four doors.
Let's talk about the one in front of the Porsche. Was it a sedan?
I don't know the brand.
No.
A sedan is a type of car, not a brand. Four doors, trunk,
Like a police car?
Yes, like that.
Bosch thought about Alicia Kent's description of her missing car. Do you know what a Chrysler 300 looks like?
No.
What color was the car you saw?
I don't know for sure, but it was dark, black or dark blue.
What about the other car? The one that was behind the Porsche?
Same thing, a dark sedan. It was different from the one in front. Maybe a little bit smaller, eh? But I don't know what kind it was. Sorry.
The boy frowned as though it was a personal failing that he didn't know the makes and models of cars.
It's all right, Jesse. You're doing fine, Bosch said. You've been very helpful.
Do you think if I showed you photos of various sedans, you could pick out the cars?
No, I didn't see them enough. The lighting on the street wasn't good, and I was too far away.
Bosch nodded, but was disappointed. He considered things for a moment. Mitford's story matched up with information provided by Alicia Kent. The two intruders to the Kent house had to have had transportation to get there. One would have taken the original vehicle, while the other took Alicia Kent's Chrysler to transport the cesium with. It seemed like the obvious thing. His thoughts prompted a new question for Mitford. Which way did the second car go when he drove off?
He also made a U-turn and drove down the hill.
And that was it?
That was it.
What did you do then?
Me? Nothing. I just stayed where I was.
Why?
I was scared. I was pretty sure I had just seen some guy get murdered.
You didn't go check on him to see if he was alive and needed help?
Mitford looked away from Bosch and shook his head.
No, I was afraid. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Jesse. You don't have to worry about that. He was already dead. He was dead before he hit the ground. But what I'm curious about is why you stayed in hiding for so long. Why didn't you go down the hill? Why didn't you call 911?
Mitford raised his hands and dropped them on the table.
I don't know. I was afraid, I guess. I followed the map up the hill, so that was the only way I knew back. I would have had to walk right by there, and I thought, what if the cops come while I'm walking right there? I could get blamed. And I thought, if it was like the mafia or something that did it, and they found out I had seen everything, then I'd be killed or something.
Bosch nodded. I think you watch too much American TV up there in Canada. You don't have to worry. We'll take care of you. How old are you, Jesse?
20.
So what were you doing at Madonna's house? Isn't she a little old for you?
No, it wasn't like that. It was for my mother.
You were stalking her for your mother?
I'm not a stalker. I just wanted to get my mother her autograph or see if she had a picture or something I could have. I wanted to send something back to my mom, and I don't have anything. You know, just to show her I'm okay. I thought if I told her I'd met Madonna, then I wouldn't feel like such a, you know. I grew up listening to Madonna because my mom listens to her stuff. I just thought it would be kind of cool to send her something. Her birthday's coming up, and I didn't have anything.
Why'd you come to L.A., Jesse?
I don't know. It just seemed like the place to go. I was hoping I could get in a band or something. But it's looking like most people come here with their band already. I don't have one.
Bosch thought Mitford had adopted the pose of the wandering troubadour, but there had been no guitar or other mobile instrument with his backpack in the squad room.
Are you a musician or a singer?
I play the guitar, but I had to pawn it a few days ago. I'll get it back.
Where are you staying?
I don't really have a place right now. I was going to sleep up in the hills last night. I guess it's the real answer to why I didn't leave after I saw what happened to that guy up there. I really didn't have any place to go.
Bosch understood. Jesse Mitford was no different from 1,000 others who got off the bus every month or thumbed it into town. More dreams than plans or currency. More hope than cunning, skill, or intelligence. Not all of those who fail to make it stalk those who do. But the one thing they all share is that desperate edge. And some never lose it, even after their names are put up in lights and they buy houses on top of the hills.
Let's take a break here, Jesse, Bosch said. I need to make a few phone calls and then we'll probably need to go over it all again. You cool with that? I'll also see about maybe getting you a hotel room or something.
Mitford nodded. Think about the cars.
and the guy you saw, Jesse. We need you to remember more details.
I'm trying, but I...
He didn't finish, and Bosch left him there. In the hallway, Bosch switched on the air conditioning in the interview room and set it at 64. It would soon cool off in the room, and instead of sweating, Mitford would start to get cold, though coming from Canada, maybe not. After he chilled for a while, Bosch would take another run at him and see if anything new came out. He checked his watch. It was almost 5 a.m., and the case meeting the feds were organizing was not for another 4 hours. There was a lot to do, but he still had some time to work with Mitford. The first round had been productive. There was no reason for him not to think there was more to be gained by a second go at it. Out in the squad room, Bosch found Ignacio Ferres working at his desk. He was turned in his seat and was typing on his laptop on a slide-out table. Bosch noticed that Mitford's property had been replaced on the desk by other evidence bags and file folders. It was everything from SID that the case had spawned so far on the two crime scenes.
"Harry, sorry I didn't get back in there to watch," Ferres said. "Anything new from the kid?"
"We're getting there. I'm just taking a break."
Ferres was 30 years old and had an athlete's body. On his desk was the trophy awarded him for being his academy class's top achiever in physical conditioning and testing. He was also handsome, with mocha skin and short-cropped hair. He had piercing green eyes. Bosch stepped over to his own desk to use the phone. He was going to wake up Lieutenant Gandil one more time to give him another update.
"You tracked the Vic's gun yet?" he asked Ferres.
"Yeah, I got it off the ATF computer. He bought a .22-caliber belly gun 6 months ago, Smith & Wesson."
Bosch nodded. "A .22 fits," he said. "No exit wounds."
"Bullets check in, but they don't check out."
Ferres delivered the line like a television commercial huckster and laughed at his own joke. Bosch thought about what was lying beneath the humor. Stanley Kent had been warned that his profession made him vulnerable. His response was to purchase a gun for protection. And now Bosch was betting that the gun he'd bought had been used against him, had been used to kill him by a terrorist who called out the name of Allah as he pulled the trigger. What a world it was, Bosch thought, when someone could draw the courage to pull the trigger on another man by calling out to his God.
"Not a good way to go," Ferres said.
Bosch looked across the two desks at him. "Let me tell you something," he said. "There are no good ways to go."
Chapter 9. Bosch went to the captain's office to refill his coffee mug. When he reached into his pocket for another buck for the basket, he came out with Brenner's card, and it reminded him of Brenner's request to be updated on the possibility of a witness. But Bosch had just finished updating Lieutenant Gandil on what the young Canadian said he had seen and heard at the Overlook, and together they had decided to keep Mitford under wraps for the time being. Until at least the 9 a.m. meeting, when it would be put-up-or-shut-up time with the feds. If the federal powers that be were going to keep the LAPD involved in the investigation, it would become clear at that meeting. Then it would be quid pro quo time. Bosch would share the witness's story in exchange for a share of the investigation. Meantime, Gandil said he would send another update through the department's chain of command. With the latest revelation of the word Allah cropping up in the investigation, it was incumbent upon him to make sure the growing gravity of the case was communicated upward. With his mug full, he went back to his desk and started going through the evidence collected from the murder scene and the house where Alicia Kent had been held while her husband did the bidding of her captors. He was already aware of most of what had been found at the murder scene. He started removing Stanley Kent's personal belongings from the evidence bags and examining them. At this stage, they had been processed by forensics, and it was okay to handle them. The first item was the physicist's BlackBerry. Bosch was not adept in a digital world and readily acknowledged this. He had mastered his own cell phone, but it was a basic model that made and received calls, stored numbers in a directory, and did nothing else, as far as he knew. This meant that he was quite lost as he tried to manipulate the higher evolution device.
Harry, you need help with that?
Bosch looked up and saw Ferris smiling at him. Bosch was embarrassed by his lack of technological skill, but not to the point where he wouldn't accept help. That would turn his personal flaw into something worse.
You know how to work this?
Sure. It has email, right?
It should.
Bosch had to get up to hand the phone across both of their desks. About 6 o'clock yesterday, Kent was sent an email that was marked urgent from his wife. It had the photo in it of her tied up on their bed. I want you to find it and see if there is a way you can somehow print it out with the photo. I want to look at the photo again, but bigger than on that little screen. As Bosch had been speaking, Ferris had already been working the BlackBerry.
No problem, he said. What I can do is just forward the email to my own email account here. Then I'll open it up and print it out.
Ferris started using his thumbs to type on the phone's tiny keyboard. It looked like some sort of child's toy to Bosch, like the ones he had seen kids use on planes. He didn't understand why people were always typing feverishly on their phones. He was sure it was some sort of warning, a sign of the decline of civilization or humanity, but he couldn't put his finger on the right explanation for what he felt. The digital world was always billed as a great advancement, but he remained skeptical.
Okay, I found it and sent it, Ferris said. It'll probably come through in a couple minutes and I will print it. What else?
Does that show what calls he made and what calls came in? Ferris didn't answer. He manipulated the controls on the phone.
How far back do you want to go?
He asked.
For now, how about going back till about noon yesterday?
Bosch replied.
Okay, I'm on the screen. You want me to show you how to use this thing, or do you want me to just give you the numbers?
Bosch got up and came around the row of desks so he could look over his partner's shoulder at the phone's small screen.
Just give me an overview for now and we'll run the whole picture down later, he said. If you tried to teach me, we'd be here forever.
Ferris nodded and smiled.
Well, he said, if he made or received a call to or from a number that was in his address book, it is listed by the name associated with the number in the address book.
Got it.
It shows a lot of calls to and from the office and various hospitals and address book names, probably doctors he worked with, all through the afternoon. 3 calls are marked Barry, and I am assuming that was his partner. I looked up the state corporate records online, and K&K Medical Physicists is owned by Kent and someone named Barry Kelber.
Bosch nodded. Yeah, he said. That reminds me that we have to talk to the partner first thing this morning. Bosch leaned across Ferris's desk to reach the notepad on his own desk. He then wrote the name Barry Kelber down, while Ferris was continuing to scroll through the cell phone's call log.
Now here we are after 6, and he starts alternately calling his home and his wife's cell phone. I get the feeling that these weren't answered because he's got 10 calls logged in 3 minutes. He was calling and calling, and these were all made after he received that urgent email from his wife's account.
Bosch saw the picture beginning to fill in a little bit. Kent had a routine day on the job, handled a lot of calls to and from people and places familiar to him, and then got the email from his wife's account. He saw the photo attached and started calling home. She didn't answer, which only alarmed him further. Finally, he went out and did what the email instructed him to do. But for all his efforts and following of orders, they still killed him on the Overlook.
So what went wrong? He asked out loud.
What do you mean, Harry?
Up at the Overlook. I still don't understand why they killed him. He did what they wanted. He turned over the stuff. What went wrong?
I don't know. Maybe they killed him because he saw one of their faces.
The witness says the shooter was wearing a mask.
Well, then maybe nothing went wrong. Maybe the plan was to kill him all along.
They made that silencer, remember? And the way the guy yells out Allah doesn't make it sound like something went wrong, makes it sound like part of a plan.
Bosch nodded. Then if that was the plan, why kill him and not her? Why leave a witness?
I don't know, Harry. But don't those hardcore Muslims have a rule about hurting women? Like it keeps them out of nirvana or heaven or whatever they call it?
Bosch didn't answer the question because he didn't know about the cultural practices his partner had crudely referred to. But the question underlined for him how out of his element he was on the case. He was used to chasing killers motivated by greed or lust or any one of the big seven sins. Religious extremism wasn't often on the list. Ferris put the BlackBerry down and turned back to his computer. Like many detectives, he preferred to use his own laptop because the computers provided by the department were old and slow, and most of them carried more viruses than a Hollywood Boulevard hooker. He saved what he had been working on and opened up his email screen. The email forwarded from Kent's account was there. Ferras opened the email and whistled when he saw the embedded photograph of Alicia Kent, naked and tied up on the bed.
"Yeah, that would do it," he said,
meaning that he understood why Kent had turned over the cesium. Ferras had been married for less than a year and had a baby on the way. Bosch was just starting to get to know his young partner, but knew already that he was deeply in love with his wife. Under the glass top of his desk, Ferras had a collage of photos of his bride. Under the glass on his side of the workstation, Bosch had photos of murder victims, whose killers he was still looking for.
"Make me a printout of that," Bosch said. "Blow it up if you can, and go ahead and keep playing with that phone. See what else you can find."
Bosch went back to his side of the workstation and sat down. Ferras enlarged and printed out the email and photo on a color printer located at the back of the squad room. He went over and retrieved it, and then brought it to Bosch. Bosch already had his reading glasses on, but from a desk drawer he pulled a rectangular magnifying glass he'd bought when he noticed that his prescription was no longer strong enough for the close-up work. He never used the magnifying glass when the squad room was crowded with detectives. He didn't want to give the others something to ridicule him with, either in jest or not. He put the printout down on his desk and leaned over it with the magnifier. He first studied the bindings that held the woman's limbs behind her torso. The intruders had used six snap ties, placing one loop around each wrist and ankle, then one to link the ankles, and the last one to link the wrist loops to the loop connecting the ankles. It seemed like an overly complicated way to bind the woman's extremities. It was not the way Bosch would have done it if he were trying to quickly hogtie a perhaps struggling woman. He would have used fewer bindings and made the work easier and quicker. He wasn't sure what this meant, or if it meant anything at all. Perhaps Alicia Kent hadn't struggled at all, and in return for her cooperation, her captors used the extra links in order to make the time she was left bound on the bed less difficult. It seemed to Bosch that the way she had been bound meant that her arms and legs were not pulled behind her as far as they could have been. Still, remembering the bruising on Alicia Kent's wrists, he realized that no matter what, the time she had spent hogtied naked on the bed had not been easy. He decided that the only thing he knew for sure from studying the photo was that he needed to talk with Alicia Kent again and go over what had happened in more exacting detail. On a fresh page of his notebook, he wrote down his questions about the bindings. He planned to use the rest of the page to add more questions in preparation for an eventual follow-up interview with her. Nothing else came to mind during his study of the photograph. When he was finished, he put the magnifier aside and started skimming through the forensics reports from the murder scene. Nothing grabbed his attention there either, and he quickly moved on to the reports and evidence from the Kent house. Because he and Brenner had quickly left the house for St. Agatha's, Bosch had not been there when the SID tech searched for evidence left behind by the intruders. He was anxious to see what, if anything, had been found. But there was only one evidence bag, and it contained the black plastic snap ties that had been used to bind Alicia Kent's wrists and ankles, and that Rachel Walling had cut in order to free her. "Wait a minute," Bosch said, holding up the clear plastic bag. "Is this the only evidence they bagged at the Kent house?" Ferras looked up. "It's the only bag they gave me. Did you check the evidence log? It should be in there. Maybe they're still processing some stuff." Bosch looked through the documents Ferras had obtained until he found the forensic evidence log. Every item removed from a crime scene by the technicians was always entered on the log. It helped track the chain of evidence. He found the log and noticed that it included several items removed by technicians from the Kent house, most of them tiny hair and fiber specimens. This was to be expected, though there was no telling if any of the specimens was related to the suspects. But in all his years working cases, Bosch had yet to come across the immaculate crime scene. Plain and simple, it was a basic law of nature that when a crime takes place, it always leaves its mark, no matter how small, on the environment. There is always a transfer. It is just a matter of finding it. On the list, each snap tie had been individually entered, and these were followed by numerous hair and fiber specimens extracted from locations ranging from the master bedroom carpet to the sink trap in the guest bathroom. The mouse pad from the office computer was on the list, as well as a Nikon camera's lens cap, which had been found beneath the bed in the master bedroom. The last entry on the list was the most interesting to Bosch. The evidence was simply described as a cigarette ash. Bosch could not think what value as evidence a cigarette ash could be. "Is anybody still up there in SID from the Kent house search?" he asked Ferras. "There was a half hour ago," Ferras answered. "Buzz Yates and the Leighton's woman, whose name I always forget." Bosch picked up the phone and called the SID office.
"Scientific Investigation Division, Yates."
"Buzz, just the guy I wanted to talk to."
"Who's this?"
"Harry Bosch. On the search of the Kent house, tell me about this cigarette ash you collected."
"Oh yeah, that was a cigarette that had burned down to just the ash. The FBI agent who was there asked me to collect it."
"Where was it?"
"She found it on top of the toilet tank in the guest bedroom. Like somebody had put their smoke down while they took a leak and then forgot about it. It burned all the way through and then out."
"So it was just ashes when she found it?"
"Right, a gray caterpillar. But she wanted us to collect it for her. She said their lab might be able to do something with..."
"Wait a minute, Buzz. You gave her the evidence?"
"Well, sort of, yeah. She..."
"What do you mean, sort of? You either did or you didn't. Did you give Agent Walling the cigarette ashes you collected from my crime scene?"
"Yes," Yates conceded. "But not without a lot of discussion and assurances, Harry. She said the Bureau of Science Lab could analyze the ashes and determine the type of tobacco, which would then allow them to determine country of origin. We can't do anything like that, Harry. We can't even touch that. She said it would be important to the investigation because they might be dealing with terrorists from outside the country. So I went along with it. She told me that once she worked an arson case where they found a single ash from the cigarette that lit the fire. They were able to tell what brand, and that tied it to a specific suspect."
"And you believed her?"
"Well, yeah, I believed her."
"So you gave her my evidence." Bosch said it in a resigned tone.
"Harry, it's not your evidence. We all work and play on the same team, don't we?"
"Yeah, Buzz, we do." Bosch hung up the phone and cursed. Ferras asked him what was wrong, but Bosch waved the question away. Just typical Bureau bullshit.
"Harry, did you get any sleep at all before the call-out?"
Bosch looked across the desks at his partner. He knew exactly where Ferras was headed with that question. "No," Bosch answered. "I was awake. But lack of sleep has nothing to do with my frustration with the FBI. I've been doing this for more years than you've been alive." I know how to handle sleep deprivation. He held his mug of coffee up.
Cheers, he said.
It's still not good, partner, Ferris responded. Your ass is going to be dragging in a while.
Don't worry about me.
Okay, Harry.
Bosch went back to thoughts about the cigarette ash. What about photos? He asked Ferris. Did you pick up photos from the Kent house?
Yeah, they're here somewhere.
Ferris looked through the files on his desk and came up with the folder containing the photos and passed it across. Bosch looked through them and found three shots from the guest bathroom. A full shot, an angled shot of the toilet that showed the line of ash on the tank lid, and a close-up of the gray caterpillar, as Buzz Yeats had called it. He spread the three shots out and used his magnifier once again to study them. In the close-up shot of the ash, the photographer had put a 6-inch ruler down on the tank lid to give the shot scale. The ash was almost 2 inches long, almost a full cigarette.
See anything yet, Sherlock? Ferris asked.
Bosch looked up at him. His partner was smiling. Bosch didn't smile back, deciding that now he couldn't even use the magnifying glass in front of his own partner without getting ripped.
Not yet, Watson, he said.
He thought that might keep Ferris quiet. Nobody wanted to be Watson.